This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by BlackStarLabs.com, one of the best-tasting protein powder out there. You can check them out at BlackStarLabs.com. Don't forget to mention the FitCast when you place your order. The opening of this week's podcast features the song Elevator Love Letter by Stars. Check it out on iTunes. Welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 176. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me this week is Lee Peel of LeePeel.com. What is up, Lee?
God, that is a high amount of episodes. 176.
Like, once you get over 175, it just sounds like, wow, it's too much.
Yeah, I guess it's it. It's time to pull out.
So, and that's not even counting the random stuff that we've done in the 0.5 episodes.
Oh yeah, that's right. There are 0.5s out there.
The 199, or what was it? 149.5. The edge. I don't know. It's gonna make a radio joke, but that's not gonna be good at all. So yeah, we are a day late, a dollar short, and we're
find out why listening to the off topic.
Yep. by the way. Outstanding off topic, not biased. Outstanding off topic this week, all of, very much to do about music. If you want some new music to listen to and you aren't a horrible person, you're going to probably listen to it and enjoy the recommendations.
Mm. Word.
Lee, can you feel the effect of my new shock mount?
Is that a come on?
It could be, but it's my microphone thing.
Just kidding. I was not aware you had one.
Yeah.
Do you have a pop? Do you have like a pop filter?
I have the pop filters in the mail. I bought a mic stand, a shock mount, and a pop filter. The pop filter hasn't gotten here yet, and some new Sennheiser headphones.
You sound amazing.
Does it sound? I hope it sounds pretty good. And if I like now, if I type, like, or if I hit something,
that was banging your fingers on the desk. I'm not going to be fooled by these special effects.
Yeah, well, that happened, and anyways, I don't know where I was going with that. Interview with Steve Cotter is going to be coming up in a little bit. That is going to be coming somewhere in between the segment with Where in the World is Jonathan Fass and the mailbag that he and I are going to be recording.
Can we get a little map? Can we get a little map and put a picture of John and like get him in like a little like striped sweater and it's just going to like stick in places and then take pictures of it, and when we have a Where in the World segment, like pop it up somehow just to make me happy.
I'm not joking. I am dead serious when I say this, but if anyone in our listenership belongs to an a cappella group and can cover the Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego song with Where in the World is Jonathan Fass, I would be in your debt.
Yeah, that would be pretty awesome. Where in the world is Carmen? Yeah, we need a baritone.
Tell me.
Baritone. Na, na, na. You know? Where was he? You know, we can even like kind of bring it up, like modernize it.
Lee, my musical expertise ended with the recorder in third grade. So.
What, Mister? I've got a shock mount and a pop filter.
Cross buns. That's all I could play.
Well, I think someone should get on it. Listeners, get on it.
It also,
I want to hear the like Glee version of like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
You know, I never, this is somewhat off topic, but I've never seen that show, and I probably would really like it, but I saw Jimmy Fallon has been doing some kind of parody of it on his show, and he did it with the cast of Parks and Recreation, and it was probably one of the best things I've ever seen in my life.
Didn't see that. I'm sure it's brilliant, though.
Jimmy Fallon's underrated, I think.
He is underrated. I love Jimmy Fallon.
So That interview with Steve Cotter is coming up. We're going to be talking about kettlebells and some more guest info. John Berardi is going to be coming on the show shortly. He's going to be coming on. I can give you the exact date. He's going to be interviewed on the week of the 27th. So we need to get those questions in ASAP so we can make sure we get them answered by Dr. John Berardi. And he's going to be coming on and talking nutrition. I think it's good to get John to come on, and maybe we will talk about Greens Plus, or I know he's doing it. He has had like a certification for precision nutrition now. Oh man, that means I have to say that damn word. I can't say it. Precision nutrition.
Just say PN, dude.
So John, what's up with the PN? Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah. What's up with the new PN certification? Holmes. Wicked, wicked, wicked.
Okay, this just got really, really bad. Also, Todd Durkin is still coming on the show next week. So I also am going to need questions for Todd Durkin. And I forget which day I'm interviewing him. It's somewhere on my schedule. But I will, you know, so we need questions by the end of the week. So if you can send in those questions, and we're trying to make sure we get you a new guest on the show every single week. Because that's how we roll. Next up, I want to quickly mention we're going to be doing another contest. All right, we just did our Twitter and Facebook contest and iTunes store reviews. And we had some winners. We sent out some Valside, sent out a T-shirt and a $100 gift card for the TRX website at fitnessanywhere.com.
Ooh.
So that was pretty big. And we're going to be doing it again right now with the blog contest. So this is for anyone out there that has a blog. Okay, so it could be your training blog. It could be your just like you talk about whatever blog. But anyways, to get into this contest, you have to write a blog post about the FitCast, link to the website, mention an episode. You could even say your favorite episode or what you like most about the podcast. Okay? I will be able to track all those links. I'll be able to get them all. So don't worry about that. We get trackbacks. If you have a blog, you probably know what that is. But I will be able to, and even make it easier, link to this week's podcast, episode 176. And just talk a little bit about the podcast and, you know, say what you like about it. Say how you think Tony needs to grow a pair and to put away the magic wand for the rest of his life. It's just not cool. And, you know, he's still not married. So, you know, getting up there.
Oh, my God.
I'm just kidding. I love Tony. Tony's a man. And so that's that. So if you want to enter in, we're going to have the list of the prizes by next week. We're going to run this for 2 weeks, so it can be episode 176 or 177 when it comes out, and we're going to have some cool prizes for you. I'm going to give away another set of Val slides, all right? I'll give away another T-shirt, but we're also going to have another grand prize that's going to be out of this world. It's going to be crazy. I promise.
Can I enter? I have a blog.
You can enter, Leafiel.
All right. Yeah. I always hate that, you know, you're connected to, like, the company, so you can't enter contest things. Always pissed me off. Not that I was really connected to the company, but I always thought, God, that Pepsi guy must be really mad. So I'm down now. I'm really excited.
How's he going to get tickets to the 50 Cent concert now?
Right? Today. What is it? What up? Stop me.
Tell me you Stop played me. That game, Lee. Tell me you put that in the Xbox.
I did.
Yes!
It was awesome.
Yo, Fitty, go blow up that big ass car.
Wrong on so many levels. It was great. Afterwards, I felt completely corrupted. I'm still going on it there. I'm not done.
Good. Everyone should own that game. It's awesome.
I did play it.
Lee, you ever have the Greens Plus bars? I'm looking for a new protein bar.
Recommend
a new protein bar. I know you've talked about the zero impact stuff.
Okay, well, is money an option? You know what I mean?
Part of the reason is because, you know, the bars that I usually get, the price has been hiked up. So I'm starting to like at least open. I'm open to new options now.
Well, see, I'm really in love with the U bar thing right now because I'm all about like non-commitment and having control because that's my personality. And so I get to go on a website. I go to U-Bar. I can make whatever I want to make. And plus, I have, like, sensitivities to, like, proteins because I'm a dork. And so I can put whatever kind of protein I want into
What's
it.
What's this website?
Ubar.
Like Y-O-U?
Y-O-U-B-A-R. You make the bar, you custom order them, and they are delivered to your house.
I just got a Chinese website with Chinese
people. It's ubars.com.
Oh, bars.
Ubars.
Don't go. Ooh, that's not good. That's not safe for work. Not a video podcast today. It's all right. All right, cool. We got it. Nice. Ubar. I like that.
So you can make your own bar.
So we can make a fake-ass protein bar?
We could.
Holy crap. It's
a very clean, like it's if you are into kind of clean, if you will. But I do like it because it's like whole ingredients. I can specify the kind of protein I want. They taste good. The company's good. It's a good company. But it is a little bit more expensive.
They are kind of expensive.
Yeah, see, that's why I said. So like if money's an issue. But I thought since I'd give them a little plug anyway. But I don't know. I usually go with I either do something like this or I make my own, you know, because they always kind of break me out protein bars for the most part because I can't have the whey. So I don't usually buy a lot of them, but I've tried like all of them. I used to have a big problem with those tri protein cookie things, but they make me break out like crazy.
Have you ever had things?
The tri-protein cookies? Yeah, whatever. I don't know. But the cookies, the chocolate chip cookies, they are amazing. I don't care what anybody says. Those things are the bomb. Have you ever had them?
I don't think so. I think I saw someone at work eating one the other day.
Yeah, well, they have more unnatural ingredients than anything you could possibly pick up. But they're so good.
I can get a fiber infusion in my bar? The Fitcast bar has to have fiber infusion in it. Keeping your regular.
But there's a bar they used to have. I can't remember. I used to recommend it to clients all the time that were a little bit more sensitive, but it was also like a whole food kind of thing. Like it was just the protein and then like dates, you know, and like a little sugar, whatever natural sugar, like evaporated cane sugar. I can't find it. I'm looking for it. I can't find it, but I don't know. Do you like the Greens Plus bars?
I don't think I've ever had them.
They're not bad. I mean, you know, they're all kind of like the same kind of thing. I think my favorite taste-wise would have to be like the kind that, you know, you make or like these and the Zero Impact bars, but they're really expensive. And
yeah, Zero Impact bars, the problem with that is like they're like 400 calories. So I'd have to cut them in half. And
that never works.
Damn.
Because you just end up eating the whole thing.
Oh, I mean, you can't cut that thing in half. It's like cutting like it's... Like those people that cut half a Snickers bar. I'm only going to eat half.
Who does that? Does somebody actually do that? Does that actually exist?
One of my friend's moms used to do that. She'd buy one friggin' candy bar and we'd have to split it and be like, you cheap bitch. Buy us both a protein bar. Or buy us both a, you know, man, what if I don't like Snickers? Maybe I want Skittles.
That is so weird.
All right. They don't listen to the podcast. Is that all right? Hey,
I really hope your friend's mom checks out what her son's friend went up to. Oh, that Kevin Larrabee. He was such a sweet thing.
Have you heard this weird thing? But like my mom's friend randomly just started searching for people she knew on Google. And she searched for my name and she finds like the most random stuff, like video game websites, obviously the Fitcast, like YouTube, child molester in New Hampshire,
nice,
who is about 6 years old, which is awesome, and also someone that got arrested dealing drugs.
Are there really that many Kevin Larrabees? Like I just can't imagine that. Like that's that common of a name to where you've got like you know Fitcast superstar and well, then child molester and drug dealer.
That's
all I have. The cook, there's like some cook out there that has my name. I mean there's some other Leap Hills, but otherwise I own google me, bitch. That's the shirt I'm gonna get, you know.
The best thing is that when you look at the pictures of me, you get to you get like obviously the Tracy Anderson picture shows up, but also the Photoshop version of me like ripped with a 8-pack. Pretty solid.
That is what shows up. That's awesome.
Can you believe that?
That's great.
And weirdest stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with, let's see, what do we want to do first? Let's do the mailbag. Then we'll talk to John. Then we will talk to Steve Cotter. So stick around. All right, we're here with Jonathan Fass, the Dr. Jonathan Fass. He was overseas at the moment in an undisclosed location in an oil rig off the coast of Central America.
What's wrong with you?
How's that oil
taste? What am I like? What is this, like the plot of 24? Like season 4 or something?
No, this is actually the opening of Armageddon with Bruce Willis and Billy Bob Thornton.
Never saw that.
Are you kidding? It's on. It's like probably on TV right now.
Not that I can tell.
So, John, let's talk about some stuff. We got a little segment here with just you because we're still working out some scheduling things. And you guys already heard Lee a couple minutes ago, hopefully.
And it was wonderful.
It was wonderful, John. Sure. You got to listen to that, right?
In the future, yes.
Awesome. Are you going to listen to the podcast still when you're not on, like, all the parts?
I don't even know if I listen to it now, dude.
That's pretty horrible of you.
So sometimes just if I said something really stupid, sometimes I listen just to hear how stupid it was. That's about it.
Okay, so we're going to be just shooting it with John and shoot from the hip because we got a couple questions for John that we wanted to make sure we answered this week. And also, we're going to talk a little bit about the controversy going on with Mike Boyle and the NSCA. Because John, through his move and everything like that, didn't even see this. Like, this has been kind of a big deal with with the NSCA, which obviously holds, gives out the certifications for the CPT and their CSCS, which for, in a lot of people's eyes, is the gold standard in the industry right now, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm. And, more or less.
Yeah. And, I have my CSCS. I obviously went through their certification process. I thought it was good. It wasn't great. And I think it's, I think it's obviously important for people to get certified to be doing what we do. But in the last couple of weeks, Mike has had it come out that the NSCA has now banned him from speaking at any of their future engagements, which, I think they do a couple summits every year, and they also do a tour, but Mike first posted on his blog at mboyle1959.wordpress.com, which I have to get on him for actually getting like a domain for that, but the gist of it is that his views on lower body training and aerobic conditioning were frowned upon by the members of the selection committee, and at least this is what Mike believes, and he hopes this isn't the reason, but this would be obviously a degree of censorship, and he says he's openly criticized NSCA on his website, so he admits to that, and he did write a strengthcoach.com forum post critical of the certification process, and he stands by what he said. And quote, the NSCA certification test is the opinion of certain members of the NSCA committee. If you want to pass, simply study the answers in the book, end quote. And, to some extent, yeah, sure, that's definitely the case. It's a general base of knowledge, It's it's, the general requirements needed to go on somewhere else. And I think it's really scary. You can't luckily, you can't just be someone that comes off the street and takes the test. You need to at least go through the book. You need to know about heart rates. You got to know about at least a baseline of plyometrics, the way your body gets stronger, the way you put on muscle, fat loss, calories in versus calories out. You know, whether you agree with everything that's in the book, obviously no one's we're in one of those industries where no one's going to agree with everyone's not going to agree with everyone, and if we all did, that would suck pretty bad. And I mean, John, feel free to jump in anytime, but he says, just going on for people who haven't read it, and I really recommend that you do, he's kind of going out of his way to go present there because they really don't even cover expenses. Like, it actually costs him money to go out there. And this is kind of blown up from people emailing a bunch of the members of the NSCA, and the head members of the NSCA, and then, continuing to, talk about, help perform better. You get, a different kind of speaker there. You get Alan Cosgrove, you get Todd Durkin, et cetera, et cetera. So, I don't know. It's a very interesting read. It's an interesting situation, and it's a situation. It's like, by the way, this is off topic, totally off topic, but they're bringing, have you heard about this, John? They're making,
what's that?
They're making a Jersey Shore TV show for Boston. For people from Boston. How horrible awesome. Is that?
Awesome.
So we're going to have like dudes saying, like people saying wicked. And there's other really horrible words that Bostonians say.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's wicked awesome, man. Wicked awesome.
But it is wicked awesome.
That was just for you, John. I know you're tired. It's midnight where John is right now. Midnight 30 almost.
Midnight 30.
But John, now obviously, what's your opinion on this? I mean, you've kind of been out of the loop, but you've gotten to read it.
My take on it, honestly, is that I don't really agree with Mike. I mean, I understand where he'd be kind of put off by it. I certainly would be too if I was suddenly told, thanks but no thanks. And only basing it on what he's written here, I don't know anything otherwise. But, I mean, the NSCA is a private organization. It has the right to decide who they want to present at the national conference and who they don't. And if he's saying things that they don't agree with, why would they have him present? I mean, it's – and further, it's things that have been critical of the NSCA and apparently things are things that are go against the recommendations of the NSCA. And the NSCA, for what it's worth, is evidence-based. I mean, again, it's a muddy kind of area for us in strength and conditioning because we have evidence. We don't have very good evidence, and we don't have very good evidence for many things. So we're still in this quasi, evidence-based practice thing, but most of the stuff that we get is through expert opinion, which is still part of the ladder of evidence-based, but it's a very low rung. It's the lowest form of evidence.
You kind of followed this where you were previously, right?
What's that?
In terms of – we kind of talked off the show about how where you were doing your – what was it called? In Delaware.
Residency?
At your residency, like, everything had to be backed up by research.
Yeah, everything.
Everything that you did with your clients, you had to have research to back it up. You couldn't just have them do something, even if you knew it worked, even if you knew it was going to fix the person, it had to be backed by research.
Right.
So you have some experience dealing with this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was called out for exercises. They'd be like, what's this working? And I'd be like, oh, it's an RDL. It's working the hip extension. How do you know? How do I know? You know what I mean? And if I couldn't come up with the EMG data to support that, I couldn't use the exercise. Mm-hmm. It was that strict. It drove me nuts sometimes, but it was, and granted, I still don't practice that way, in terms of like saying, well, I don't know what the RDL is doing, so I'm not going to have anyone do it. but it does at least put your mind in a certain place, saying that, you know, what's the difference between what you know and what you think? And those are two very, very, very different things. What you know is backed by research and evidence that demonstrates clearly that, you know, cause and effect, and this is the reason for what happened or whatever, you know. So if you introduce an exercise and the person gets stronger and there's evidence suggesting that that exercise works this muscle, then you can say this exercise was responsible for that muscular gain. You know, it sometimes it gets a little ridiculous. And on the other side of it, and I respect this argument too, one of my professors in grad school, when I visited her, my program after I graduated, we were talking about evidence-based, and she's, you know, she has her postdoc, she's a neurophysiologist, she does, I mean, research is her life. And she said to me, she looked at me and she goes, do we need to do a study to prove to you that I'm not an elephant? So I think that that's legitimate too. You know, there's evidence-based, and then there's just, let's not be stupid. You know, we don't need evidence when it's very blatantly obvious this is what it is. But I think when it comes to most of the things that we do, either in strength and conditioning, you know, or in rehab, there are very few things that are as obvious as the fact that I'm not an elephant, you know. Mm. I was actually just on the men's health forum, and
You're still
I brought up. Yeah, I've been messing around with it over there. It's kind of, you know, the old stomping grounds. So I got so much time. Yeah, you, man. By Penn 8. Yeah, well, Lee won't give me the password to her forum, Lee Peel.
Yeah, Lee Peel. What's up?
Lepahole.com. She keeps being like, oh, I sent it to you. I didn't get crap from you, Lee.
No, I thought we got an email saying we were going to get in on that or something. I forget half the emails that I got, like, yesterday.
I know. But anyway, we were talking about they're doing a study right now, and I guess I can't really give you like the full details of it because it hasn't been published yet. But basically what they're doing is a study on low back pain. And in one group, they do like all this, you know, mobilizations and core strengthening and all this stuff that you would say this is the forefront of low back pain rehab. And the other side of it, they're doing, they literally call it passive modalities. They do a little hot pack, really, really, really light massage, like that doesn't even do anything. You know, like it's basically like a sham. But the idea behind it is that this is what is quote unquote accepted practice. There's people still do it this way, and that's rehab at some clinics. And so obviously the better stuff is going to work, you know, the manipulations and the core strength, that's going to be the stuff that works. Problem is both groups are getting better. And it's absurd. I mean, it doesn't make sense. They haven't crunched the numbers yet. So maybe the group that you're doing the mobilizations on is getting better quickly, you know, more quickly than the other group, or maybe their cure, quote unquote, it will last longer. Like, we don't know what the actual outcomes will be, but as of right now, just looking at the data coming in, both groups are getting better. So that's a perfect example of where we think we know. And if I just asked you, hey dude, you know, if I had low back pain, what would you want me to do? You know, you'd probably give me some idea of like, you need some flexibility, you need some strength training, you need whatever, but we don't have evidence that that's the best way to do it. We don't have any evidence to suggest that that's actually a better methodology than some other stuff. This study is, in a sense, attempting to prove that, and it may actually not prove it, you know? So that's where evidence is something that's important, and I think people lose sight of that, especially in forums. They, you know, just talk about that so-and-so strength coach said this, so this is what it is. And so, you know, we were talking also on men's health about the idea of CNS fatigue, how everyone, oh, you're gonna blow out your CNS if you do that's a bunch of crap. I've never heard of such a thing. You know, you can fatigue the CNS, your central nervous system when you exercise, that's why your form starts going to hell. But the idea that this like thing that's floating around the internet now where people are like, you know, if you do too much volume, you get CNS fatigue. Like, it used to be called overtraining. I don't know where the CNS fatigue crap came from. And it sounds to me like just someone trying to sell an article or a book. You know, that's not evidence-based. Or if it is, it's bastardized evidence. It's not something that's actually been shown. Again, there's CNS, there is fatigue. There's central and peripheral causes of fatigue and exercise, but I've never heard of something suddenly shutting down the CNS or whatever they claim happens because you did an extra set of curls, you know? So, wow, that was a completely random off topic.
I was trying to stop you a little bit, but
I don't know where that came from, but we were talking about the idea of the NSCA being evidence-based. So, They base their recommendations and evidence. You may have other studies that you think contradict the evidence, or you think that their evidence is not suggestive of the population that you're working with and therefore doesn't apply to you. But the fact of the matter is it is in evidence. And, you know, guys like Bill Kramer, who have literally written the book on exercise physiology and are some of the guys that are leading researchers in exercise physiology, are the guys that made those recommendations. So, you know, I'm not quick to go against that all the time. So if Mike chooses to do so, he has a good reason. He's working with guys day in and day out. But if the NSCA doesn't like that, it's their right to say they don't like it and they don't want him presenting. I don't have a problem with that.
I'm gonna jump in for a sec.
What's that?
I'm gonna jump in for a second. I know my connection is not great, but basically to give my kind of two cents on it. Number one, I think that the reason this is kind of getting to be a big deal is because Mike's one of the bigger voices in full disclosure. He writes my checks, but But you know, one of the reasons why I went to go work for Mike is because he is the leader in the industry. I mean, people go to him to see what he's doing. We have mentorship groups in there every 2 months of people that pay money to come in and spend a week to see what Mike's is doing at the facility and seeing what works. And people go to seminars. They go to Perform Better. They spend hundreds of dollars to go see him at seminars to see, you know, to hear him speak, to get his opinion, and then they take it and then they do the same thing. And, you know, the reason why Mike has gotten that far is because he does get results. He is incredibly well-read, and he knows what he's talking about. And I think the reason why this is a big deal is because it kind of scares, or it kind of disappoints a lot of people that, you know, one of the leading organizations doesn't want to hear what he has to say because he disagrees. And I think I don't know if it's because I don't know if it's more of because he spoke poorly of them on you know, the internet because of their testing, or if it's because of them having philosophical differences when it comes to training people, because I don't think they would have that stance because it would be kind of suicide. In a large crowd, in the strength and conditioning crowd, because a lot of people, for better or worse, if Mike says something, they're going to kind of go along, you know, they're going to trust him. Like if someone, what's a good example? Mike said to buy Nike Freeze because, you know, someone said that Nike Freeze are, great shoes. They're nice, very flat shoes. They don't have the huge shock on the end. And you go to a Perform Better seminar, everyone's wearing Nike Freeze. You know, and I think it's something kind of in the on the lines of that, you know, people will listen to what Mike has to say and, they will back him up. I really think they will because they do they follow his stuff. I mean, they buy his DVDs, they read his articles, and I mean, again, I go back to my previous point. There's a reason for that, but the and there was another point I was going to make, but again, I kind of lost it. But I think that it's just a very interesting situation. It'll be interesting to see how it pans out. This is basically as, you know, TMZ as this industry is going to get, where we have this kind of controversy. And I don't even think it's a controversy. I mean, I think it's a situation where there's a disagreement, and, you know, Mike felt like, you know, he had to say something about it. He wanted to let people know why he's not going to be speaking at the NSCA conference this year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of blown up, and it's,
yeah, I mean, I'd be, again, if I were him, I'd definitely be put off about it. I just don't think that, but, you know, and that's fine. Again, I mean, I don't think that I have any, I mean, I don't have any issue with it either way, but I don't think I have any issue with Mike being disappointed by this. I would be disappointed too. And I would be disappointed to not be able to hear Mike speak at the NSCA conference if I were going, because I would want to hear Mike speak because I love listening to him speak. But as far as saying, like, you know, this is censorship and that, you know, I don't agree with that. I think that it's just their decision.
Okay, yeah, I can agree with that.
It's not censorship. I mean, not the way that I would call censorship, especially because, again, they have the right to decide who they want, you know, speaking at their national conference. And quite frankly, you know, if Mike's been critical of them, why would they be so quick as to ask him to speak? Mm-hmm. I mean, I see it as a pretty cut and dry sort of thing. Like, I mean, and again, it doesn't even necessarily mean that I agree or disagree with Mike, because, you know, the test is what it is. You know, whatever he's been critical of them for, like, that doesn't necessarily mean that I disagree with it either. But if I came out and said, oh, the NSCA, you know, their testing is crap, and, you know, it's opinion and whatever, and I'm the guys on the board of the NSCA, I'd be like, forget this guy. If he doesn't like us, then he's not going to talk for us. I mean, that's pretty simple. So, I don't know.
I mean, good. I mean, it's still for discussion. I think we should move on because we do want to get to those questions before.
Sure.
John has to cuddle up into his sleeping bag and go to bed.
Yeah.
All right. So the first one that we have comes from, and these are kind of older questions that I was able to grab from the darkness of space, but this is a question from Gord from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Believe it or not, of all places.
I believe it.
Do you? He says, what up, guys? I'm resending from a couple weeks ago. I was wondering if this is something you have covered previously, and if so, if you could point me to the podcast. I'm a 33-year-old male, 6'2", about 175 pounds. I've competed in several sports throughout my life, primarily track and field, hockey, and basketball. I've started cross-country mountain bike racing last year and decided to really ramp up my training this winter. Based on my training partners' and teammates' suggestions, I bought a heart rate monitor. They assumed that it would help me train better, as I could monitor how my body is reacting to the training by reaching a target heart rate. I've always had a good sense of perceived effort, and I thought the theory of using heart rate was a bit off, but I decided to give it a try. What I found is that my heart rate fluctuates significantly, primarily based on the time of day when we are training. For example, when we do spin intervals in the morning, I get my heart rate to 196 every time, which would be a perceived effort of approximately 95%. When we run the exact same program in the evening at the same perceived effort, my heart rate only reaches 187 every time, except this past Monday, which I reached 201. My resting heart rate is 58 beats per minute, and I haven't had my max heart rate tested, but obviously it is it's in the 200s. My training partners don't experience these types of fluctuations, and they're concerned about my high heart rate. I feel fine when I am at a high heart rate, and I Had I not had a monitor, I wouldn't think I did anything out of the ordinary. My question to you are, is it normal that your heart rate fluctuate based on the time of the day? Is pushing my heart rate into 200 dangerous? With the results I am getting with my heart rate monitor, is it really providing me any benefit? If so, how can I use this information to help me train more efficiently? Thanks, Gord. And I think it's an awesome question. It would go back, just give people a couple stats, 33, 6'2". About 175 pounds. And the first thing that ticked me off, or, you know, like I checked off in my head, is the difference between heart rate in the morning and in the evening. And and I had, or I should say, I have a client right now who takes medication in the morning. And when he trains in the morning, his heart rate actually is significantly higher than it is in the evening. When he, I mean, he takes the medication like right when he wakes up, then right when he goes to bed, and that causes his heart rate to get jacked up quite a bit. And it's I'm not going to go into the medication; it's kind of personal stuff. So, but I think that's the first thing I would ask you, Gord. Are you taking any kind of medications? Are you taking any kind of supplements? Or are you taking any kind of caffeine before your training in the morning? That obviously will have a great effect on that heart rate. John, do you want to tackle some of the stuff in terms of heart rate being in the 200s and, you know, will his heart explode? Is the heart rate a good tool? Heart rate monitor.
Will his heart explode? I doubt his heart will explode. I hope not. Heart rate variability throughout the day.
Still got his question. Maybe we'll send him a t-shirt if it does.
Yeah. Heart rate variability throughout the day is natural. And we see differences in hormonal responses throughout the day, metabolic rates, blood pressures, all kinds of stuff. We have natural daily fluctuations with all that. So training intensity and heart rate response and physiological response to your training stimulus can vary throughout the day. And some people are just feel naturally better in the morning. Some people feel naturally better in the afternoons or the evenings. And that's perfectly normal. And I would be willing to bet if you check their heart rate at their preferred time versus their, you know, the, what they perceive as like a poor time, you'd see differences there too, because, you know, which, you know, and which one is which, you know, it's probably all tied in together. But all of that is natural, and it's not something to worry about unless you're seeing like really significant differences of probably like, honestly, I don't know what to say. I would be concerned clinically speaking, like 10 to 15 beats, like 15, 15 probably. I'd kind of raise an eyebrow and just sort of make sure I monitor that. But otherwise, completely normal. As far as if 200 is safe, I remember we're doing a study at Rutgers. I wasn't involved in it, but one of the PhDs was telling me they were working with the soccer team, the men's soccer team, and they were having heart rates well over 200 in their exercise program, and these guys were moving around like it was nothing. You know, they were barely even, you know, felt like they were exerting, and their heart rates were like through the roof. Heart rate is very variable. The formulas that we use for heart rate are really not terribly accurate. What is accurate is if you do have a stress test, so you know, it's almost like a one rep max in a sense, but for your heart. So you understand where your max heart rate is, and then you can adjust accordingly your exercise intensities. But using the formulas, really kind of ballpark at best. So I can't really tell you if 200 is safe or not, but if your heart rate is getting up there and you're not feeling like, you know, this is a bad experience, you're saying like, well, this is very high intensity, but I feel fine, then chances are it probably is. Our body signals us that it has warning signs when the heart rate is getting too elevated. So I would still recommend, you know, going to see an exercise physiologist, you know, cardiac physiologist, and having a stress test. Why not? You know, and knowing your numbers and making sure that you're safe. But in general, my clinical judgment would say that chances are it's probably okay. If you've been exercising, you're already active, I wouldn't be as worried. If you were brand new to exercise, I might be a little bit more worried and say maybe that's a bit much. But the fact that you're already in good shape and you're active in multiple sports, I don't know that I'd be as worried because you've already been adjusted to activity.
Go to the bathroom while you answer that question.
Hmm?
I was able to even go to the bathroom while you answered that question.
No, that's awesome.
It is. Last question we have comes from Justin. Time.
Horrible.
You know what? I am in a world right now where I actually get people will watch. I think it was Deb who's watching Back to the Future, listening to the podcast. Just because she was watching Back to the Future too, she, you know, like I gotta let Kevin know on Facebook. So. Put a little message on Facebook. Kevin just heads up watching Back to the Future 2, which, sorry, is actually the worst of the three. But, you know, it's like saying, you know, it's the worst awesome thing ever.
Oh, God. I actually saw the fail, like, growing.
Hey,
as
John.
As you were searching for.
Why don't you shut the hell up and I'll ask you this question.
It was amazing. All right, what's the question?
My name is Justin from Brisbane, Australia. Loving the fake ass. The amount of free information provided on a weekly basis is just fantastic. Keep up the good work. My question is this. I've been working on Wendler's 5-3-1 for the past 2 months. I'm seeing great strength gains, but the problem lies with squatting. It never came naturally to me, and I find the only way to achieve half-decent form with good depth is with plates under my heels. A Google search revealed that this could be due to tight calves / poor ankle dorsiflexion, so I've been stretching and foam rolling religiously, but haven't seen much of improvement. Do you have any tips or insights? Any help would be greatly appreciated. On a side note, does anyone know the reason for ridiculous price increases of supplements in Australia? To illustrate, Bioctus Metabolic Drive is $30 in America. Same product for the official Australian site is $70. One Australian dollar equals 92 American cents. Hell, Flame Mode is $90 a bottle for fish oil. That's me ranting. Thanks again, Justin. And Justin, you know what? Same thing's happening in America. Biotest just raised the price of Spike to $60 a case.
Hmm.
From $40.
Wow.
So I think I might actually need to look for a new source of happiness. I don't know how I'm going to fill that void. I'm probably going to start doing real drugs. And I hope you're happy. John, let's talk a little bit about ankle mobility. And also...
Fail.
Why is that? You don't think it's an ankle mobility issue?
No, I thought that your drug reference is a fail.
Oh, well, the first thing I'm going to point you to, Justin, is if you search for ankle mobility, believe it or not, and I'm actually going to do it right now to make sure it's still there. If you search for ankle mobility, the very first result at the top is a video of Bill Hartman from October 10th, 2006. That's 4 years ago, doing a little ankle mobility video for the one and only FitCast from episode, like, 8. Of the podcast, and I recommend you check that out first. Although it's from, it says, I think you said fitcast.com. It's really the fitcast.com. That's okay, Bill. I'm sure you still helped us out with some awesome traffic, and it's a great video. So what do you think? What do you think, Dr. Fast?
I doubt it's the ankle mobility. Personally, when you have poor ankle mobility, you can squat to a certain point. Going further is typically a painful experience, but you can squat down to, it, you know, roughly parallel before you start getting into problems, depending on the width of the feet, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, it does not, in my experience, does not end up being ankle mobility. And in fact, one of the best ways to get ankle mobility is to squat. Because you're forcing the range of motion while you're squatting, and again, assuming that it's not a painful experience, that you're not going beyond your limitations, it's a great way to basically gain dynamic flexibility. I think it probably has more to do with muscle imbalance or form imbalance, and they can probably be one and the same. When you elevate the heels, you're artificially shifting your weight forwards, and you're producing your, I guess arguably you're using the quads a little bit more than you would normally in quote unquote proper form. I don't know that I can really say that definitively, but you're definitely avoiding a certain amount of hip flexion when you do that. If the person squats with a wider stance, almost like a powerlifter kind of stance, what you would think of there, the data will show that you will use the posterior chain more effectively that way. So you're going to train yourself to squat a little bit better, and that if there are any mobility issues in the calves or the ankles, you're going to kind of help yourself out that way, because you need less ankle range of motion when you squat with a wider stance. So you're kind of getting the best of both worlds. You're going to improve your balance. You're going to kind of force yourself into a better squat, and you're going to kind of work around any mobility issues that might be there, which again, I really doubt are part of the problem. As you get better, it's balance. It's understanding your form and your position and being able to use your muscles properly to get in that position. You can start, possibly bringing your feet in a little bit closer together if you want to have a closer squat. There's nothing wrong with a wider squat. So if that's what you got to do, then I don't see a problem with that. But I don't think it's mobility. It's very rare that I've ever seen anyone not be able to do an exercise because they didn't have at least sufficient range of motion just from daily activities. And that, you're really talking about he'd have to be, permanently placed in a certain amount of plantar flexion in order to not have enough range of motion to squat, at least to parallel. So I just don't buy it.
Cool. Well, fair enough. John, I'm going to let you go.
Thanks, dude. I'm tired. Can you tell how tired I am?
No.
I am. I love our listeners, and that's why I'm up at 1 in the morning.
John does love our listeners, and, it's really good that you say that. I don't know where I was going with that. So that's it. We're going to get back to the rest of the show. We're going to bring Lee back on, and Lee and I are going to answer some questions from the mailbag, so stick around. All right, guys, we're all ready to open. I don't. We're not going to keep that one.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are, and you're going to keep me laughing at it. We have the mailbag, and you first question, Kevin, and I've already done it, so you can't erase it now. Okay, so Kevin, hi everyone. I'm sort of new to the FitCast, still haven't caught up to all the past episodes, so this question may have been answered. I know it was asked before, but not really answered maybe a year ago. A listener wrote in asking whether it is better to lift post or pre-run. He was 135 pounds and 5'5", or somewhat close to that. You all told him to quit running and pick up some weights as he was underweight. That's all fine and good, but even though I have a similar body size, my goals are slightly different, so I wanted to ask. I am female, 5'5", 135, and a regular runner. I do a long run on Saturdays, cross-training twice a week, and do high-intensity interval runs or speed work runs twice a week. The only time I have to lift is those weekday running days. Is it better to do so before or after my runs? During racing season, I want to increase my speed distance efficiency, while during the winter, my goal is to lose fat and increase muscle. Is there a benefit to lifting pre or post run, or am I completely overthinking this? This seems to be one of those topics where the answer changes every other day. So any suggestions or advice would be greatly appreciated. Again, love the FitCast. Thanks for the great info.
That's an interesting question, and I think we did mention this in the talk about this a little bit, maybe 20 episodes or so ago. But for one thing, that was a male that was emailing in, and not a female, so there's one difference there. The one thing I'm going to quickly bring up is you said you had different goals, but you didn't mention what your goals were. So I'm guessing it's let's just say it's physique based, but if you're doing, seem to be doing all this cross training, you maybe you're training for a triathlon or maybe even like half marathons, marathons, stuff like that. But I will address the main question, which is lifting pre or post run. And if it was me and if I was advising a client, I would say for the most part pre-run and make sure it's mostly heavy body upper body dominant, because I would be worried about having you do tons of lower body volume and then going out and running 5 or 10 miles. Like I think that might be a little bit too much. It makes you a little bit more at risk for injury. Again, that's being a little bit overcautious, but you got to keep that in mind. Maybe there's one day where you can just cut out the conditioning for the most part, and maybe you can condition instead on an air done, something where you're sitting down, you're a little bit less likely to injure yourself or have that fatigue of your legs really cause an issue, and make that day your lower body dominant day. Get in your lunges, get in your, if you deadlift, get in your deadlifts, and just dedicate one day just for lower body strength and muscular development, and make sure you hit all the bases. Make sure you hit your glute activation work. Make sure you're hitting glute med, because again, it sounds like your main goal isn't to be stronger, but it's to, it sounds like it's to compete, or at least to complement your running and the other stuff that you do. So just make sure you're doing your glute med activation, do your X-band walks, things like that, that are just going to make sure you keep your knees healthy and you keep your lower body healthy, and you don't have that knee pain starting to kick in. Make sure you're still doing your ankle mobility work. That can be a big problem with people that run quite a bit. You'll see that they're always plantar flexing, and then they have issues dorsiflexing. You'll actually see that there's a they'll have negative degrees of dorsiflexion when you test it, which is pretty scary. I unfortunately am one of those people that does it, but it's because of the way that I sit at my desk for the most part, and I walk funny. If you've met me, it seems that I do kind of walk with almost like a little bit of bounce, at the end. I don't know why that is. I do have awesome looking calves, so I'm not really worried that much. And my ankle mobility doesn't hurt any of the other stuff that I do in my lifting. So hopefully that helps. Lee, do you have anything to toss in there?
I thought that was good. I mean, I feel the same way about the fatigue that you're going to hit. I guess if I had anything to add, you put that she put during racing season, she wants to increase speed, distance, efficiency, etc. During the winter, she wants to lose fat. I always like to throw in this for runners, and especially if there's runners that need to work on their physique, but losing fat does help with speed, distance, and efficiency. Whenever you can decrease the fat, it will help with the impact on your body. It'll help with the running. And, if that's still something that you need to do, get on that, get it out of the way. I don't really, understand why runners do almost like a bodybuilding season thing where, they go on and off season. It doesn't make much sense to me. To me, just get the fat loss out of the way completely and then just focus on your running and mobility and training and things like that for the time being. But, yeah, other than that, yeah.
Lee, you ready for the next question?
I am ready.
Hi, guys, and Lee, spelled incorrectly. Just wondering if there are any foods you could recommend for keeping energy levels up throughout the day. I work in a very dimly lit office space with little air movement and zero daylight. I find myself growing extremely lethargic in the afternoons, and it's making it very difficult for me to get any work done. Any suggestions as to what kind of foods I should be eating, or at least resort, or as a last resort, what kind of supplements I should be taking to keep energy levels spiked throughout the day. Thanks. Thanks in advance. I could add the obligatory keep up the good work. I really enjoy the show, but that goes without saying. Thanks always for the entertainment and the countless epic fails. That's from Robert.
Well, I don't want to speak for Kevin, but I always appreciate the obligatory congrats, thanks, and what have nots. But it's kind of a funny question, I think, because To some degree, you know, people, I get asked a lot, like, what kind of foods can I eat for energy? And it's like, well, you know, all food is kind of energy based. I mean, that's what it is. It's calories, and calories are energy. Obviously, carbohydrate foods are going to provide you the best source of energy. You know, eating small amounts frequently is going to sustain that energy, you know. So, like, for example, if you took I recommend this a lot for just people who get kind of fangy at work in general, because a lot of time people recommend nuts, and I just think that's just the worst thing in the world to tell people to do, because one, they're like high in calories. I mean, it's great if like you have a lot of calories to burn, but if you're sitting in the office all day chowing down on bags of nuts, I mean, that's gonna add up. And I don't know, like, yeah, they're great for satiation, but I really don't think nuts are the best I don't know, office snack. I just don't think they are, but that's a rant for another day. But I like fruit in general as office snacks. It's portable. You can kind of eat it slowly, like oranges especially, or clementines. Mandarin oranges are kind of my favorite. But you know, you get like a two huge like seedless like navel oranges and just kind of peel and bite a little bit, and it's great. The little snack foods for the office, and the calories are pretty, you know, low in comparison to say something like nuts or any sort of other food. You could kill off like three oranges for like what you could have like a handful of almonds. So and it's carbohydrate based. It's going to be more energy. It's going to hit you a little bit harder, but you know, it's not like there's a it's fructose, so a mix, and the crash isn't like, you know, quite as bad, if you will. So I definitely like, I like fruit for kind of office snacking. I think that it's good for that. Obviously, there's other things that you can snack on throughout the day. But another thing that I wanted to interject is, you say that it's dimly lit. And if possible, and I don't know how possible this could be, because all of a sudden you could be the weird blue cubicle guy. But I'd recommend, if possible, to get a blue light to take with you to your office and turn it on whenever you're feeling fatigue, and utilize a blue light and or stare at the blue light. It mimics sunlight. It's lots of good research has been done on it. I use one to help me get up in the morning. It's good for seasonal disorders, or it's good if you have like delayed onset sleep pattern problems, which I do. And basically it's good for helping for fatigue throughout the day. If you don't know what a blue light is, basically what it is it's a blue light. It's a very, very bright blue light. You turn it on and you know, you can either look directly into it if you really need to pick me up, or you can kind of let it be like glowing on you towards the side, and let it run for about 15 minutes, and no placebo. After it, you really do feel awake and you feel better. And sometimes it can be hard to keep the habit up. And like I said, you know, if you're like sitting in a dim office and all of a sudden it's like, you know, coming like out of like your cubicle or something, some people might find that to be a little weird. And I don't know, that's like kind of a personal decision. You could like take it with you to the bathroom if you're feeling incredibly insecure, and just, you know, be the blue light guy that's in the bathroom, and people make fun of you then, but at least not right to your face. So, yeah, I suggest that. Also getting up and doing random, like just mobility movements. I mean, just a few like, you know, scap rolls or you know, levator stretch, arm claps, just something that's obviously not too aggressive in the office, but you'd be amazed with just kind of moving your body a little bit, just jumping up and down, just getting yourself kind of moved, and it will get you out of the fatigue. I, you know, tell people to set timers on their computer to just alert them to just, you know, get up, stand up for a second, move around on every interval of the hour if possible. So just some ideas. Kevin, you got any others?
Pretty good. I was going to make sure you mentioned the blue light.
And I did.
You did. You could also get a tanning bed.
You could. Although they tax you now for that. So.
I know, but now I got free health care.
Word. Okay.
this ain't going into that. Hey,
Leah. We're not going to go there, right?
Leah, I got a question for you. It's from Sean. Hey, guys. First of all, thanks for being awesome. You guys have helped me lose 16 pounds already. My question is about plant proteins versus meat proteins. I have been slowly changing my diet towards a vegetarian style rather than conventional meat eating style. I was curious though, if plant proteins are a valid source compared to meat. I've heard that plant proteins do not contain all the essential amino acids that meat proteins do. I'm curious that you were about your thoughts on this and if a vegetarian diet is a feasible diet for muscle building. Thanks again, sincerely, Sean. And I'm going to lump this into someone from Uraka, I guess is the best way to say that, from Twitter, who sent me hemp protein.
What's the deal? What's the deal with the hemp protein? Okay. I mean, let's see. Plants and animal proteins. It's a popular question. It's not so much the amino acid profile of vegetarian towards a meat eating diet that could have any sort of concern. Well, I guess I'll start from the beginning. I mean, amino acids are amino acids. Every food or every protein-based food, any food that has protein in it, is going to have a different kind of setup of amino acid profile, if you will. It's some are going to be higher in amino acids than others, you know, and it's just going to range from food to food to food, which is why it's not so much preaching meat or no meat or plant protein or no plant protein, whatever, but more so variety. Variety is more important than anything else, because if you eat only plant-based proteins, you eat only just one kind of plant-based protein, like, for example, you're vegetarian, but the only kind of protein you ever really get is like from beans, you're probably going to run into some problems, not so much because it's a plant protein, but because you're not getting a lot of variety of amino acid profiles into your diet. So you could do something to like make up for it by, you know, getting in like branched chain amino acids or something like that. Usually not the case though, because the average person has a pretty good variety in their diet. If you're just vegetarian, meaning that you're not vegan, there really shouldn't be any problems. If you get in dairy, if you get in, eggs at all or anything like that, it should more than cover your bases. You can get specific proteins like hemp protein or things like that, and all it is it's just another protein. Hemp protein is fine. Some people try and make it out to be something it's not. I don't really get what that's about. It's just a protein like any other protein. I mean, at the end of the day, I feel like that if you're going to look at a protein champion, you're still looking in the like kind of whey casein areas. It's not a protein that seems to lead towards a lot of aggravation. It doesn't seem to provide people with a lot of irritation. Anyone that has problems with intolerances or allergies from powder-based proteins, which for whatever reason, be it allergies or intolerances or just some sort of like, digestive issue that comes along with it, a lot of people can have a hard time with whey and casein. So if you do, there's the options of rice, soy, hemp, et cetera, pea protein. And all those proteins have pretty, great profiles. Some of them are better than others. I do think hemp kind of has a little bit of a bar with the way that it's put together most of the time in packages than some other things. But at the end of the day, it's a taste and cough's preference. I think it's not weed. And I saw a bunch of people buying it the other day that I think they thought it was. But that's another story that was funny. Yeah, so sad. So sad when 13 and 14 year olds see hemp on a product, regardless of God, that
blast me back to high school where like kids right, wore there was those kids that wore hemp everything
but regardless of that, it's more so the other vitamins that sometimes you have to be concerned about. For example, meat is the only source of certain B vitamins, sometimes vegetarians or vegans, more so than I should say than vegetarians, can find issues with iron and or B vitamin, things like that. As long as you're making sure that you're covering your multivitamin bases and you're making sure that you get in. I just call it insurance. It's not that vegans or vegetarians cannot be healthy. I just think that they need to be a little bit more careful and cover their bases, because at the end of the day, be your moral reasons, physiologically speaking, we need certain things. So just make sure that you get those certain things, and you can get them through animal friendly sources, and you can get your vitamins through, I guess, more ethically happy places that don't utilize animals in any way, shape or form. So just cover those bases. Other than that, there's no reason that you can't build muscle or maintain your muscle or do anything like that on a vegetarian diet. It's perfectly fine. So have at it. But I think that's a general misconception that for some reason the the amino acids are worse in plant foods, and that's not necessarily the case. It's just different profiles. They're higher in certain areas and lower in certain areas. So there we go.
Yeah. Cool.
Yup.
Haley, do you want to grab the next question from Chris?
From Chris. Okay.
Something about
diets. Does it start with the one thing?
The one thing.
Okay. I couldn't tell how it was set up. Okay. One thing that I have to ask deals with diets. Everyone generally knows what they should be eating, but no one actually does what they're supposed to do. What strategies would you suggest to get clients to be compliant to their meal plans? I murder myself personal training clients in the gym only to have them go home and eat the garbage that has them at 30% body fat. What do you tell your clients to get them to buy into the lifestyle of eating clean, Chris?
This is a super interesting topic.
It is an interesting topic, isn't
this
it?
This could be like a roundtable topic.
It could be a roundtable topic. We could make it one right now.
With two people?
Yeah. You know, it's...
We'll just sit next to each other.
Yeah.
All right. More of a
rectangle, like, yeah. And or we could call it head of the table. It's a head of the table, you know, you at one head, me at the other.
Is that head of the class reference?
Not really.
That was
you can make
my
it.
Time.
It was before your time.
But I know the reference. All right, so I think this is a really good question, and there's a lot of ways that you can tackle it. And I think the one thing you need to look at is that every one of your clients is going to be a different situation. There isn't going to be a one size fits all that's going to address this issue with every one of those clients. So I think the first thing you need to do is kind of get a feel of what kind of a person that they are. And I think, Lee, you're going to be awesome to talk to about this. But what I've done with a couple of my clients is, you know, some of them kind of have deadlines that they want to reach a certain state. And I kind of given them a couple options. Like I've literally said, now, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get you to where you want to go, but you're obviously going to have to pull your own weight. You know, I'll come in and I'll train you. If you want nutritional guidance, I can give you that. You know, I can even, you know, harass you and make sure I email you in the morning and see, make sure you had your omelet, make sure you ate breakfast, because, you know, I've one client that literally is always just waking up, going right to work and not eating till 10 o'clock after being up for 3 hours and than having, you know, junk food, because that's kind of what's around. Or maybe if it's even clean junk food, and maybe it's clean food, but then they have a ton of it because they're so damn hungry. So, you know, it can be something as simple as that. I've even had, like, you've seen my client Kim that I've had on the website, who was, I was just like, Kim, you know, we can make this real. I can just put pictures of you on the internet. And like, I know that works. Like, I know, I mean, it works with the FitCast accountability bloggers. Like, they put pictures of themselves on the internet, and those that stuck with it got results. I mean, they had support from, you know, the thousands of people that visit the site. And I think that's, it's a little bit of external pressure that can go a long way, just having some kind of accountability. It doesn't have to be the internet. I had another client, I said, all right, I need you to take pictures, and I need you to have your boyfriend take those pictures. Like, I want him, you know, to know that you're doing this, and I want this to kind of be a group effort. And if, as long as you're comfortable with it, you know, have him take pictures. Don't even show them to me. I don't need to see him. You know, as long as you're seeing the changes in your body every week, then that's all that matters. So, you know, little things like that, and you know, it really is. You might just have to try a couple different things with each one of those clients and see which one gets them to stick. And some of them won't. I mean, you could spend hours and hours and hours with them, and just some people out there are just gonna want to come in twice a week, exercise, and stay where they are weight wise, and just have no problem going out drinking with their friends, or you know, going out to the Chinese food buffet place and getting a bunch of food with their friends, because that's what they like to do. It's something that they don't want to give up. And, you know, maybe that the body composition changes that they have, that, you know, that's not as important to them as socializing or continuing to do what they're doing right now. So it can be something that's really tough, and it takes, you have to kind of get experience with it and see what works. But I know Lee can talk about this for quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different for every person. I think there's a point in which that as a trainer, you have to step back and say that you don't have any control over what your client does, nor should you. It's their life. It's what they do. What you can control is the amount of help that you can offer them. And, you know, basically, yeah, I have very kind of strict feelings on my clients that are paying clients. If they don't do what it is I ask them to do, I don't work with them anymore. And I don't do that because I'm mean or because I am overly perfectionist, although I am a perfectionist. But I look at it as you're hiring me to do a job. And if I can't do my job, you need to find someone else who can do that job if it's not me, or you need to find yourself before you start giving me money again to do the job, because I don't take the amount of money that I get from someone to do my job lightly and take it very serious. So I guess to some degree, you have to examine how serious you take your job and how much you want your clients to get their results. And you can't really sacrifice their results for the sake of just running through the motions, because I catch a lot of trainers running through the motions, and what you're willing to accept is what that they will give you. At the end of the day, people are always like that. What you are willing to accept is what people will give you for the most part. So I guess my biggest hint or tip to you is don't accept less than what it is that you really want. And if it comes to the position or point in time in which that you have to let a client go, you let them go and don't feel bad about that. Aside from that, though, I think one of the biggest things that a lot of personal trainers get caught up in, and one of the things that I guess that I noticed from what you said in your question, is how can I get them to buy into the new style of, or the new lifestyle of clean eating? I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means, and I don't really know why anyone should be buying into any style of anything. You know, I know so many trainers that are into like paleo, right? Like they're really into like the caveman. I don't eat bread. I don't do anything like that, and they try and convince all their clients to do the exact same thing. And there is no right or wrong way of doing something or eating things. There is no elitist way of doing things. Clean eating, for the most part, doesn't exist. It's not something that really is. Healthy eating, or eating the best variety in your diet, is about all that we can ask for. So trying to get them to acclimate it into their lifestyle as good as possible. I guess what I hate is I hate it when like personal trainers say, you know, you see them on either in TV or just in general, they go into someone's home and they look at everything that they have and they start dissecting, you know, one by one. This is crap. You've got to throw this away. And, you know, the next thing you know, you put in front of clients, you know, oh, here's your cottage cheese and a handful of almonds. And, you know, don't forget to have your like plain chicken breast. No one wants to eat like that. No one wants to do that. And for the most part, that's what a lot of personal trainers do. And for the most part, that's what a lot of people think they should be doing. And it's not the case. Variety, good whole foods, good eats, meals. And yes, it can include bread, or it can include, you know, pasta or rice. God forbid carbohydrates. Like, it can include all those things that people like to eat, and find a way to make what they like just a little bit healthier. And let them know that it's about the intake. It's about the balance of getting the good in and getting proteins, carbohydrates, fat, and just generalizing it for them as much as possible. And that their results aren't going to change in the gym as long as that they're eating too much, no matter how much they think that them doing that 45 minutes and maybe burning 250 or 300 calories is going to change everything for them. It's being real. You just got to be real with people all the time. And if you don't know what you're doing, they're not going to know what they're doing. And at the end of the day, you stay educated, you help them stay educated, and don't be too rigid with them. If them eating, you know, Subway every day is what actually helps them get to lose weight, I mean, who cares what your opinion on Subway is? Who cares what your opinion on white bread is? Like it's the part about making a change for the better and slowly allowing them to integrate that change into their lifestyle, not being so, God, like you ate white bread the other day and you're going to hell. Like my clients don't eat white bread. My clients eat, you know, broccoli and chicken and never fold like that. And I think that I guess I got a little rubbed the wrong way by the lifestyle of eating clean comment, because they're your clients. They're not, you know, necessarily what you have to say do. You've got to try and acclimate it to their lifestyle best possible and just be realistic about what people are willing to do, because the average person doesn't want to do hardly anything to change their nutrition until they start seeing positive results. And once they do and they see that they feel better on certain levels and that results are happening, they'll kind of like move into what it is that they're supposed to do for their body. So I don't know, just you stay educated, they'll stay educated, and just talk to them and don't be too preachy about it. I see personal trainers just make that mistake a lot. I don't know. That's just me though. Putting their own beliefs on their clients sometimes. But I guess we could talk about it all day, but that's just got a little rubbed by that a little bit, I think.
I agree. That's kind of scary, and especially when you talk about someone saying, you know, you got to be a paleo diet person or a zone diet person or, you know, Atkins diet. Like, I think that's very, you know, sketchy territory to get into, and it just makes
you look cool. Well, you know, and I don't even think this person necessarily, like, I don't want this Chris person to think I'm attacking him.
No,
like,
I should clear up that I mean that, I mean that's looking stupid in the sense where, like, you're just going to tell someone to go read a book. Like, you can't just answer their questions. Like, I think you should have, sound, researched information that you can give them.
If you're going to talk about it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because it's one of those things where, obviously, there's a level in which that as especially personal trainers, we aren't registered dietitians. We are, you know, we aren't. Each state has different laws, and you know, and you do have to guide by those things. And I want to make it very clear that, you know, even giving out meal plans in some states, it can be considered illegal by the board of your, you know. So you need to make sure to kind of look into those things. But, you know, I guess my point is that I get that you're frustrated or people might be frustrated, you know, with, you know, you train a client and then they go home and they eat what you consider to be garbage or what have you. But, you know, you have to allow people to change at the pace that they want to change. And the fact that they've come to you and they want a personal trainer, that's great. But people really, they don't understand this stuff. You know, they come to a personal trainer and they think, oh, I'm going to do a couple sessions and I'm going to start to lose weight. And if you don't facilitate exactly what has to happen and what's going on and what is expected of them in order to lose that weight, if you just say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to mark on this card and we're going to do some rounds. We're going to test your 1RM. We're going to see what your strength is, right? We're going to work on your mobility and all this stuff. And by the way, eat 5 to 6 meals a day and call the doctor in the morning. You know, like they're not going to get results. They're just not, you know, and maybe you might get the lucky outlier that ends up kind of, you know, naturally putting it all together. But for the most part, these people are going to be like, oh, well, I don't understand. I can't go out and have like 10 drinks after training. What? I don't, why? You know, they don't get it. And you're in the world and you do get it. And you have to take yourself out of your own head and out of your own world and say, okay, wait a second. These people are coming to me and they might be completely new. They may not even know what a carbohydrate is. They may not even understand what protein is. Like, they might not get this at all. And it is your job to the best you can within the bounds of like legal means or whatever, either point them to the right directions to the people that you trust, like say, you know, Fitcast or whoever it is that you happen to follow, so that they can continue their education of this and like learn. Or, you know, spend your training time the best you can, like trying to educate them on the things that they're doing so that they're getting results. And if they're not getting results, be like, well, what are you doing? What are you eating? You know, did you realize that these calories add up and that it's about the calories? And do you realize if you eat, you know, you can eat little calories, but if you're eating bad calories or not efficient calories, then you're not going to feel so good and you're going to want to binge more and connect the dots and help them connect the dots so they see that this is It's about efficiency, and it's about trying to get the job done as best possible while also trying to maintain health as much as possible. And I know people jump on me for saying this, and they want to like give me a hard time, but fat loss isn't healthy. Technically, while it's going on, it may lead to health, but it's hard. It's really, really hard. It drains you. It drains you of nutrients. It drains you of energy. It drains you of your ability to fight normal emotions that you have. And if you don't prepare people for the battle that they are going into, and if you don't explain to them how to defend themselves against it, what do you expect of your clients? And even then, though, you still may not get nothing because people are going to, at the end of the day, do what they want to do. But I guess my motto is to just prepare people as best possible for something that really is hard, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be having these conversations all the time. So, in rant, but yeah.
Cool. I think we're going to end it there.
Nice.
That's a good spot. We have a couple more questions, but we're going to save them for next week's show. So, as always, before we get into the interview with Steve Cotter, just want to let people know to make sure to check out thefitcast.com. Make sure to subscribe through iTunes if you haven't already. Please make sure to do that and submit a review if you like the podcast. If you don't like the podcast, then don't submit a review.
We don't want you around here. Go away. Yeah. You don't like us.
And other than that, we have some cool stuff in the works. Nothing we can really talk about right now, but hopefully we'll have something to talk about down in next month or so. And I'm going to link to it on the website, but look for my exclusive interview in the Virgin Mobile magazine. So check that out. Check that S out. And Lee, you got it. What's going on at leepeel.com?
Right now, actually, as of today, I have put up the we're having a 30-day challenge, and it's open to everyone. Prizes are different depending on if you're a member or not a member of leepeel.com.
Can I enter this?
You can enter it. Everybody can enter it. Anybody can enter. All you have to do is post a comment in the blog answering 3 questions, and the final check-in is 30 days from now answering 4 questions, and you can win. Non-members can win 3 months membership to leepeel.com and some cookbooks, and members can win all fat loss troubleshoot and body bites packages, a freestyle suspension trainer, a 90-day workout journal, and both the men's and women's health of big book of exercises.
Damn.
So it's about $1,000 value all total for all people that'll win things somewhere around there. But yeah, it's nice. It's a nice little challenge, and all you have to do is just leave a comment. That's it. Just leave a comment and say what your name is, your goal for the challenge, and why you're entering. And it's pretty simple.
Could I be driving away in a new car?
A new car.
That's what I'm saying. you got to get the Price is Right game for the iPhone. It's really good.
But basically it's the challenge is based upon a psychology test. Done back in 1945, and basically about the pressures of challenges in general and rewards. And I'm taking like a kind of different twist on it and a different spin, and I want to see how people do under a very non-pressured, challenged atmosphere. So, because I like to treat people as guinea pigs all the time, and this is just another one of those things that I'm doing. But I think it'll be fun. And so far, I just put it up last night at like, I don't know, like it automatically posted at like 4 a.m. or something, and we've got 35 responses, I think, right now. And I got some that I need to approve still. So, we're doing good. And I'm hoping to get a lot more.
All right. Well, everyone should check that out at leepeel.com. And if you haven't already, you can... I think you're cool with this, Lee. If they add us as friends at facebook.com/KevinLarrabee and facebook.com/LeePeel.
Yep, absolutely.
And same thing on Twitter. Twitter.com/KevinLarrabee and Twitter.com/... Leppo Hill. Look for the Leppo Hill post. Have you looked at the Leppo Hill posting?
No.
You should follow Leppo Hill.
Is there really a Leppo Hill?
No, there isn't, but that doesn't mean I can't make one in the next 5 minutes.
Oh, you.
I know. All right, everyone, enjoy the interview with Steve Cotter, and we will see you next week with an interview with someone. make sure you're subscribed to the newsletter so you know what's going on there. It's on the side of the fakecast.com. We'll see you next week. I can't breathe.
Oh.
I'm dying.
Oh my god. I should have sang the "Where in the World is Dr. Jonathan Fast" song.
We're still recording, so people are still hearing that.
Be like, "Where in the world is Dr. Jonathan Fast? Na na na," like something like that. I want people writing in. I want an a cappella group. I want Glee. I will give away all books, a free phone consult, and personal. I'll give a program in design,
home personal training.
I will give away so much. I'll be your whatever for like a week. Just send it in.
All right, yeah. Email that along with any other mailbag questions or questions for our guests to questions@thefitcast.com. So you can send us an MP3 or do that. And also, don't forget, if you haven't been doing it, we get to get some voicemails. So 775-45-FITCAST or 978-633-3488 and leave a message so we can you can ask your questions via the voice on the FitCast. We will have those next week, and I'm sorry guys, but they will get priority. So if you definitely want to have your question answered, send it as a voicemail and I promise we will get it on the show. So now, do you want to listen to Steve Cotterly?
Yeah.
All right, here he comes after this music.
Now Steve Cotterly.
Right now I'm with Steve Cotter. Steve Cotter draws from an extensive and diverse background as a champion athlete and cutting-edge trainer to develop some of the most complete and exciting programs in strength and conditioning today. Throughout his lifelong study, Steve continues to research and implement the most effective training methods in kettlebells, martial arts, qigong, strength training, athletics, human performance fields. He consistently improves his skills and abilities to benefit, teach, and motivate you. And also, going through some of his professional accreditations, he's consultant for several major sports teams, including the San Francisco 49ers and the San Diego Chargers, and also a subject matter expert at U.S. Navy SEALs at Virginia Beach, and strength and conditioning. It kind of goes on and on, Steve. And we can go through all the certifications, but I know people want to get through to the meat and potatoes because we have tons of fans that are fans of yours as well and are pumped to talk about kettlebell training. So first of all, Steve, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. It's really my pleasure. Appreciate you asking me.
I'm going to tell a quick story. The first time I ever saw you was way back, I think it was in 2006, at the Ryan Lee Boot Camp. And you presented, you went out on stage, and this is really the first time that I ever got to see real kettlebell training. Like I'd never seen it before. I was like 19 or 20 years old at the time, and it really blew me away, not only the training but also some of the things that you did in terms of the training. Like you're literally doing like a single-legged squat and then jumping up onto a table. Like, see, that's pretty nuts. And I think that's something that we're actually going to get to a little bit later in the questions, but I mean, I just want to start off by asking you, you know, how did you get into kettlebell training originally? How did this all start?
I was looking for a time-efficient way to get back into peak conditioning, because when I was like a teenage years, I was training all the time, didn't have a lot of responsibility, and so I kind of fell out of that daily training habit, and I was losing my conditioning, and I was looking for a way to be able to optimize the time that I did have. So that led me to see some advertisements about kettlebells, and it looked intriguing, and I just tried it out on my own at home and enjoyed it quite a bit. Just sort of went from there, tried to get more and more information at that point. This was, I guess, 8 years ago.
So originally, who were like some of your mentors, I guess, or who are some of the people that you looked up to in terms of getting information originally?
Well, for sure, at first it was Pavel. He was the first guy to really put out information on a more broad scale. So the conversation has to begin there. And then my eyes kind of got opened further back in 2005, I saw there was a group of Russians that came to San Francisco. I went up there to see them. They were Russian world champions from kettlebell sport. And Larry Durenko was one of those. He was living in the U.S. at this point. So definitely Fedorenko was definitely a big influence in terms of, you know, what I would call the more the higher level kettlebell aspect of performance. And various other champions that I was able to come across. I currently train with a Ukrainian world champion named Ola Ilika, and he's really helped me a lot as far as coaching abilities, ways of teaching techniques easier to less experienced people. So those are probably the three biggest people that have had the most pronounced effect on my kettlebell development.
One last thing I have to ask you before we get into the questions that we got from the listeners. I have to ask you, what runs through your head when you see kettlebells now being used on The Biggest Loser, and they're now becoming very popular in the mainstream? What kind of runs through your head? Is this a good thing? Is there a bad thing because you see some people using kettlebells improperly? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not really a purist, but, you know, good luck, bad luck, who can say? It's sort of everything would depend on how one views things. On one hand, it's exposure, so we could say that's a good thing. On the other hand, could probably say that the coaches aren't so well trained with kettlebells, so we could say that that's a bad thing. I'm not really attached to it one way or the other. I think that if you just look at the tool, the kettlebell itself, it's a very useful tool. I think I'm not against it. I think it's okay. You know, I know there's criticism about Jillian Michaels and her form. And, you know, I would say that her form needs a lot of work for sure. People could argue that it's dangerous, but I would argue that most of the things they do on Biggest Loser is probably dangerous anyway. You know, what I do like is that I think that the obese population is those that stand the most to gain from kettlebells, because it's, you get high intensity without the pounding. And that's sort of the perfect formula for fat loss. So for me, you know, I think it's, I would say that it shows progress, even if it's not quite where we would like it to be. It's definitely a step in the right direction. If somebody doesn't get killed, then we'll call it a success.
That sounds like a good plan. And one more thing that kind of just popped into my head, right now at Mike Ball Strength and Conditioning, we're using the Turkish getup. I should say that we're using the progressions of the Turkish getup in a couple of our warm-ups. How do you feel about using progressions in terms of teaching the Turkish getup? Do you think it should be just taught as one movement? Or when you're teaching it to individuals, you teach it kind of step by step, have them master one step, and then next week go on to another step?
Yeah, I think, well, the rate of progression would depend purely upon the individual and, of course, the communication capability of the coach. So whether it's one piece a week or everything in one day, that would vary. But I'm a proponent of breaking down movements into component parts and then illustrating one part at a time. So in the Turkish getup, there's a lot of start and stop. There's several very distinctive starting and stopping points. So for me, it makes sense to teach each component as an individual exercise, and then from there you just learn to connect the dots. That's just a way to take a somewhat complex movement pattern and present it in a very simple way. And so, yeah, that's certainly a good idea. There's a lot going on in something like the Turkish getup, so someone can get value just by taking one component and drilling that component.
Gotcha. The questions from the listeners, we got a ton of questions to listeners. I really want to thank everyone out there for submitting them. The first one that we have comes from Ruben. I asked, could you please describe the differences and similarities between the different kettlebell certifications?
Okay. Thanks for the question, Ruben. I'll speak about my own first, the IKFF. This is the International Kettlebell and Fitness Federation. our kettlebell course is referred to as the CKT, Certified Kettlebell Trainer. I would say that what we present is you could call it an amalgam of different styles, influenced at a basic level by by what Pavel was able to do with the RKC, but expanded upon from that to include what we would call professional style lifting, which is really a higher level performance approach modeled after the kettlebell sport athletes. Because when you look at kettlebells like any other sport, and you look at the top performers, you're gonna see the competitive athletes at the top of that group. People that actually get out and compete in front of and witnesses and in front of judges. So I've adapted a lot of the professional training methodologies and techniques into basic kettlebell for fitness. If you look at the RKC was the first. They're very, very successful at marketing their program. I think it's a good entry level, system for people to learn kettlebells. If you look at the AKC, which is another well-known group, that's Valeri Fedorenko. Fedorenko's definitely a master at kettlebells and kettlebell sport. So in terms of technical precision, AKC is really a great, all systems have their strengths and weaknesses. I like to focus on the strength. So it's up to the consumer to decide what they feel they get benefit from. I know that as far as what we do, nobody works harder. We provide fun, but I'm more of an ambassador to kettlebells in the sense that I go around the world and I try to collect information from different sources. If I find something that is maybe a newer or different way of doing, a way that's going to shorten the learning curve, then I'm going to integrate it into the program. So our program's really flexible in that regard. But really it's going to be up to the consumers to give their feedback and what they think. And, from an objective perspective, the RKC, the AKC, and the CKT are all, well-respected around the world. So there's probably going to be something in it for everybody in one of those programs. And what I find is a lot of real serious coaches, they end up taking all three courses simply because they're different enough and they all offer value.
If people are interested in getting like IKFF certified, where would they go to get info on that?
The first place would just be to the IKFF.net website.
Okay.
We have a calendar of event listings, course descriptions, contact information there. So people can definitely look there, see if there's a course that is of interest to them. We have them, all over in every continent. So pretty much anywhere in the world, there's going to be a course that would be relatively close to most people. And also we have a group, IKFF group on Facebook. People can also post questions there as well.
Awesome. The next question that we have comes from Roger. The question is, what is the difference in muscular development using kettlebell programs compared to lifting weights? I'm guessing he's talking about dumbbells.
Okay. Well, generally speaking, weight's a weight. So the difference usually is going to be in protocols or methodology. Kettlebells, because of its shape, it favors and encourages more of a repetition of repetitive volume. So in other words, typically if someone's using dumbbells, more often than not, they're going to be using it to develop limit strength, bulk. So most of the programs are going to be relatively heavy with lighter volume. Something like five sets of five would be an example. With kettlebells, typically we're doing much higher volume. Wouldn't be uncommon to do sets of 30, 40, 50, even 100 reps of a given exercise. So as a result, the type of tissue that you're developing, kettlebells are going to tend to build a leaner physique, definitely much more of an emphasis on cardiorespiratory fitness to balance out the strength, whereas if you're using a very typical dumbbell program, the emphasis is going to be more developing a base level of strength, but not nearly as much conditioning. So the bodies will reflect that. If someone's is focusing on putting on size, the body's going to develop a different look than if they're focusing on developing muscular endurance. So kettlebells, you're not going to have the bodybuilding look, but you're going to have a very athletic body.
Very cool. The next question that we have kind of revolves around the thought of, or I guess the suggestion that we've gotten from a lot of people that wanted to ask about training in a home gym, because a lot of people, when they go to those commercial gyms, they really don't have kettlebells there. I worked at a commercial gym for about a year ago, and I had to actually buy my own kettlebells because they just wouldn't purchase them. We actually did have these nice little rubber ones that went up to about 8 pounds, which were awesome, I must say.
Okay.
But the question that we have comes from Ben. He says, if you could only do three exercises with a client, what would they be? And, you know, I guess revolving around that too, my question that goes on top of that would be, do you think someone could just literally train exclusively with kettlebells and just still have, optimal levels of strength in terms of, being able to compete against some other guy next to him in the gym? Would they still be able to get a good enough workout where it would have nice base levels of strength and still keep up with their physique and, you know, not have too much repetition, so be able to change things up?
Okay, great question. Kind of a two-part. The first part, what three exercises, Ben asks. The bread and butter, you have clean and jerk. That's going to be an essential with two kettlebells. It's going to be a strength builder. You're moving more load. You're working a pull throughout a full range of motion. You're working a push throughout a full range of motion. So basically from toe to head, you're working. You also have a high cardiovascular output. So definitely clean and jerk with two kettlebells would be sort of your money exercise. In addition, snatch. Again, you're working full range. You're working unilateral, so you're addressing a rotational component. And then I don't think any fitness conditioning is complete unless you have some squat. So you can throw in a squat, certainly a front squat is a great choice. So if I were going to be limiting myself to three exercises, that's what I would program. Clean and jerk with two kettlebells, snatch with one kettlebell, and front squat with two kettlebells. The second part of the question, can you build a well-rounded athletic body with kettlebells? For the most part, yes. It will depend on the person. We have to look at what their deficiencies are, what their strengths are. I won't say that kettlebells is the only thing someone should do and it's all they should do. Most people need to balance out their program with other things, be it some barbell, be it some body weight conditioning. Certainly flexibility is huge. There should be some type of stretching and flexibility component that balances out the kettlebell. But at the same time, if you were going to do only one training system, kettlebells is very well-rounded. It provides a lot of things at once. You're getting your resistance training, you're getting your cardiovascular training, you're working your joints through a full range of motion. So I'm not going to go so far as to say it's the only thing you should do, but I will say that if you're only going to do one thing, kettlebells is a very good choice.
Emma has our next question. She says that I'm a 26-year-old female who has about 5 kilos to lose, but also wants to tone up her arms and midsection. She says she's highly active. She does cardio and weights at the gym twice a week, dragon boat training 3 times a week, a 30-minute jog 4 times a week, and also has recently purchased some kettlebells, a 4-kilogram and an 8-kilogram. She knows that tightening up her body will help her shed those last 10 pounds, and she's already lost 66 pounds over the last few years, and most importantly, she's kept it off. Her question is, how can I best incorporate kettlebell training into my routine and help me with toning up my arms and midsection, and maybe with shifting a bit of the weight? I know that kettlebells also incorporate legs a lot, and this is a bonus, but my legs are already quite muscular, and I think this isn't really my main focus. Can you recommend any good DVDs that I can use to train with? I don't feel like I get as much from reading books and looking at pictures as I do from when I'm watching someone live. I also just want to mention that I don't think kettlebell training has really taken off in Australia like it has in the U.S. And they have not been readily available to buy in most sports stores, and B, most of my friends have never even heard of them. Any information you could give me would be greatly appreciated. It's not often a gal like me would go get the opportunity to ask a question of someone as highly regarded as you. And again, that's from Emma.
Great. Okay. Well, first, Emma, I think you've done great to lose so much unwanted weight over the past 3 years, so you're really doing exceptionally as it is. Before I recommend a DVD, I'd just give a little bit of information that will help you. Sounds like Emma's very athletic, very active, so I really think that a 4- and 8-kilo kettlebell, she needs something a little bit heavier. Probably a 12-kilo would make a huge difference in the work capacity that she could develop. As far as the exercises for toning, it's pretty simple. You know, swings are going to be your foundation, clean, jerk, snatch. I don't think she should have too much problem increasing tone by just doing, you know, and also when you look at the methodology, you want to probably do longer sets of 20, 25, 30, 40, 50 reps at a time versus sets of 5 and 10. As far as DVDs, probably a good one for you would be either the Extreme Kettlebell Workout, which is more of a follow-along where I'm actually going through programs and the viewer can go through the programs with me. And then also the complete guide to kettlebell lifting is a book DVD combo. So it has the book is very high quality. The photos are easy to follow, but it has a companion DVD that goes over all of the exercises that are in the book. So that's a very popular kettlebell product that people really enjoying. So I would recommend either of those two for your questions. I think that that you'll enjoy both of those. I think I addressed all the points in her question. So, you know, I think if anything, you might be doing too much. You're running a lot. You're doing a lot. You know, you may want to maybe cut down on the frequency and increase the intensity by getting a heavier kettlebell. So instead of doing your work with 4 and 8, maybe warm up with 8 kilo and try to get some longer sets with a 12 kilo. Start with two-handed swings and kind of build from there. I think you'll get a lot more mileage out of that, and maybe give yourself a little bit more rest and see if that kind of jumpstarts your body into the next level of progress.
Yeah, Emma, thanks for the question. We have Steve, you have an incredibly, or I should say an oddly dedicated fan base in Australia. I don't know why, but they seem to have...
Australia's a great place. I'm there. I usually go there every year in November, do courses, and maybe Emma can find me there this year. For kettlebells, australiankettlebells.com.au is a really great resource. They're not a retail store, but they actually do have a retail store in Melbourne, but they're all throughout Australia. They have excellent customer service, excellent business. So they're definitely the go-to source for kettlebell resources and kettlebells in Australia. I don't think she'll have any problem getting what she needs if she contacts Australian Kettlebells.
Great, Emma, so, you got the information.
Hopefully I'll see you down there.
Yeah, she's got the info now. Basically, if you're going to be putting on any kind of seminars across the globe, they're going to be at fullcontact.com?
They would be at IKFF.com. Okay. Yep, IKFF.com. It has my public schedule for certification courses, workshops, master classes, and so on.
Awesome.
And they're everywhere, Europe, U.S., Australia, Asia, even Africa sometimes. So it's there's a lot of options for people that want to get out to one of my courses.
This might sound like a joke question, but when you travel for these, do you bring your kettlebells in your carry-on luggage, or do you just throw them in your regular luggage?
No. Basically, for me to do a course for the host to have kettlebells is a requirement. There has to be kettlebells there first.
That makes sense.
And if not, then we just train without kettlebells. But, you know, as far as a kettlebell course, no, I don't travel with the kettlebells.
The next question that we have comes from Scott. It says, a year and a half ago, I had arthroscopic surgery to relieve arthritis in my right AC joint. I am showing the same symptoms in my left AC joint, and 2 months of rehab is not working. I just received a cortisone shot from my orthopedist, and we both agree that I could work out on my own. I own 125-pound, 235-pound, and 153-pound kettlebells, but I am not opposed to buying lighter ones for rehab purposes. How can I use kettlebells to safely strengthen my shoulders and also maintain my physique? Since starting treatment on my AC joint, my weight has started to increase. My current routine includes push-ups, dumbbell rows, resistance band exercises for my shoulder, and interval sprinting. Bench pressing and dips seem to aggravate both shoulders. The only kettlebell movement I still use is the two-arm swing, but I am sure there are others that would not aggravate my condition. My therapist has cautioned me to not do overhead pressing and did not like my discussions of the Turkish get-up, as he said it would put too much pressure on the top of my joint. Thanks and keep up the great work, Scott.
Okay, Scott. You know, first of all, we always want to be able to help, but this is one of those areas that it would not be responsible to just give some blanket answer, because I don't know Scott's specific situation. I understand the symptoms, but, you know, the cause is a totally different issue. So we're kind of getting into the area of diagnosis / treatment, which is outside the scope of fitness professionals. Even though a lot of fitness professionals will go ahead and give that advice when they probably shouldn't. So I'm not going to say that, Scott, that you should do this particular thing. All I can really say is this is what I would do maybe if I was in that situation. I can suggest, but by no means am I saying this is what you should do, because, again, you have to really work closely with a medical professional and see exactly the dose and the formula. Exercise is like medicine in the sense that you have to have the right dose, you have to have the right formula, and it can be the best exercise in the world, but if it's not applied in a logical and intelligent way, then it's going to cause more harm than good. So that said, what I would do, first of all, with the ACL, you got to look at mechanics first rather than considering how much weight. First, we look at the body weight. And how can you learn to squat in such a way that minimizes the torque on the knee joint, on the ACL? So you really have to learn to sit way back. You have to learn to take the load off the knees as much as possible, load the hips, load the hamstrings. So I would say just really backing up, forget about load, look at body weight. And I'm not sure your flexibility issue, but or level, but starting with a box is a great place, or a chair. Learn to really perfect the movement doing box squats, sitting way back and down. And at the bottom of the movement, you should feel that the load shifts away from the knee and shifts onto the hips. If you can perfect that movement, you're going to be able to strengthen your quads, strengthen the muscles around the knee in a mechanically correct manner, not cause further problems, strengthen the surrounding tissues. Okay, so that's where I would start with regards to the rehab for the ACL and that whole process. And the other thing is, not too much too soon. A little bit of volume every day or every other day. You know, don't try to go gung-ho. Okay, with regard to the shoulder, definitely two-hand swings. I always want to look at what can you do with your body weight. You know, can you lock out the arm overhead with no weight without pain? Because if you don't have the range of motion with your body weight, then it's not going to make sense to try to add kettlebells or additional load. You have to first use just your body weight and be able to get into the position. And it's going to take some work. You know, you have to really work on the flexibility. If you can do that, then if you can get your arm overhead, then I think little by little, small volume, light load, starting to integrate some overhead pressing. It might hurt, but, you know, once the tissue is healed and you need to reintroduce the range of motion, that overhead movement such as pressing is going to be one of the best things to do. So that would be my advice first, is to focus on the mechanics, get to where you can go into the movements perfectly without causing pain, and then be very progressive in your, be very gradual in your progression. Don't try to go too heavy too soon and just re-injure yourself. Certainly push-ups is a great idea. aside from swings, you can get into one-arm cleans. You can, you know, maybe some rows, maybe some chest press when you feel more confident and your range is there to start doing some overhead. But stay away from the snatch and the clean and jerk and the more ballistic lifts until you are really confident that you have the joint stability. And once you have joint stability, then you can start doing just about anything. You know, just the main thing is to pay attention. You have to pay attention to your body, how it feels. Don't pay attention to the exercise. Pay attention to your body and how it feels. And if you stick to that, you're going to make, you know, good progress and not injure yourself. So I hope that this is helpful to you, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great stuff. Next question that we have comes from Missy. If one has a piriformis problem, causes sciatic pain, is doing kettlebells going to help or hurt? I really want to learn, and I'm trying to get to an RKC training to learn proper form, but there are none in my area, and I will have to do some have to travel some distance to attend one. But I wanted to make sure I wouldn't be wasting my time since I have this issue with my piriformis. Thanks so much, and you've probably heard this 1,000 times, but that video of you doing the pistol squats on and off of the table with the kettlebells is one of the most amazing videos I've ever seen. And again, that's from Missy.
Okay, great. Hey, thanks for the question, Missy. First of all, the fact that you're aware that it's a piriformis issue, that's good because it means that you know what's going on in your body. So will kettlebells help or hurt? Basically, you have to prepare the area. You have to certainly stretch out the piriformis as much as possible, warm up. It can exasperate a problem if you're too tight there and you already have if you have stiffness and you have pain radiating, I don't think that the kettlebells are going to help. It's probably going to aggravate. So if you start very progressively with the kettlebells, not too heavy, not too much volume, test it out. Make sure that you're doing some mobility and flexibility work in the area, and then integrate the kettlebells with it. And, you know, start easy, see how you feel the next day. And as long as you feel well, you can gradually increase the volume and intensity a little bit each time. And if you go a few weeks without any problems, then I think you can say that, the kettlebells could help. It could help by strengthening the area, but you really have to look at the mobility. I mean, they don't make injuries go away, but if you can mobilize the area, stretch it out, and then you add the kettlebells to that strength in the area, you probably will get really good results with that. As far as finding a trainer, RKC or anything doesn't guarantee that the person is a good coach. Depending on your area, you can, if somebody wants to email me a referral, it's possible that we can refer someone to Missy's area that she may not be aware of. And, I'm happy to try to help in that way if I can refer someone that is that you're able to get to, whether they be RKC, CKT, AKC, or don't get too much caught up in the letters. It's more the the capability of the coach that's more important. So hopefully you'll be able to find somebody that can assist you and get you a strong start in the basics.
The next question is something that we have, quite a bit. I'm sure you get this question quite a bit, but this is from Nadine. How do you stop, can you ask Steve how to stop the back of my wrist getting sore? It feels like the kettlebells keep banging into them.
Yeah, that's a great question. I get that question very, very often. I just put up a video clip yesterday on YouTube that addresses this very issue. So if you want, Kevin, I can provide that link and you can share that with your listeners.
Absolutely.
There's a nice visual for that. But basically what's probably happening is the setup is not correct. Most people that have that problem, they're setting up the handle facing horizontally. So if the kettlebell's on the ground, the handle's facing left to right. And then they're swinging with the straight arm. And as it snatches, the kettlebell is rolling over the top of the hand, in which case it has to decelerate. When it lands, a deceleration, it basically is banging into the wrist and forearm, and that's what's happening. The other thing is that you tend to grip very tight. So this type of hard style snatch, it sort of beats up the body, and it's not really efficient performance-wise, or if you're hurting yourself getting injured, then something's wrong, basically. It's not something that's a good idea to injure yourself during snatch. So the first thing is to change the grip. Instead of having a horizontal alignment, you have a vertical alignment. The handle's facing up to down. Your grip is you're going to grip it with the fingers versus the center of the palm. So instead of squeezing real tight with the palm, you grip with the fingers. The thumb is on top of the handle. The fingers are under the handle. So now as you swing the bell behind you and you extend into the snatch, the arm, the thumb is pointing up at this point. The thumb is pointing up. So now as it gets to chest level, you pull the arm in slightly and then you straighten your arm. And if you do this correctly, the hand is going to slide into the handle. So instead of the kettlebell flipping over the top where it has to decelerate sharply on your forearm, the kettlebell is not moving so much. It's just floating, and then you drive your hand inside the handle. So instead of your hand being passive and the kettlebell going around your hand, the hand is active and your hand goes inside the kettlebell. So that's a verbal description. It may or may not catch, but I will definitely provide to you, Kevin, a video clip that breaks this down very clearly. So I think that Nadine will be able to get it once she sees the video clip.
Awesome. That would be fantastic. The next question that we have, or that's actually our very last question, it's from Billy. And kind of just summing it up, do you have any ways of progressing people to get into or building up the strength to do a pistol squat properly?
Absolutely. There's a lot of them. One, I'll give you some basic tips here. One thing is to learn to sit on a box. Again, a pistol squat onto a box. You stand in front of the box and you sit back and down. And that's just basically to, as a progression, to reduce the range of motion initially, develop strength in a reduced range of motion, and then simply increase the range. So using like Reebok steps, start with maybe 4 steps when you can do a few reps on that. Take 1 step away, take 1 step away, take 1 step away. So using distance as an overload. The more distance, the more you have to work. So that's one way. Another way is you stand inside a doorway and you hook your hands around the outside of the doorway, and then you sit your hips back and down and just use the hands ever so slightly to help with the balance. So you can practice the movement and the hands are assisting you a little bit, develop that confidence and the strength and flexibility on one leg. Those are some of the best ways of doing it. You can use a light counterweight in your hand. So for example, grab a 10 or 15 pound kettlebell or a 20 pound kettlebell, hold it in front of you. And then as you're coming up out of the bottom position, you kind of punch the kettlebell forward so that counterweight helps to pull and offsets a little bit of your weight going back. Those are some basic things to try. If you want to get really in-depth and study, you can pick up a DVD called Mastering the Pistol, which I created as a way to really address this particular issue. It gives you dozens of different progressions and includes some different programs that you can do to work up to. We set as a goal 10 quality one-legged squats per leg, 10 pistols per leg. Then following that program, that should be a very attainable goal for you. So that's some hopefully you can try one of those techniques and we'll help to give you a hang of it. And the other thing is, just a little goes a long way, so practice. It's a skill. Don't try to kill it in one day, but just do a little bit every day or every other day. Learn the skill and improve your confidence. Get the motor pattern down, and then you'll be able to, have more success with the lift.
One last question for me, and this is really for everyone out there in the audience who might still be really new to kettlebells, and maybe they head to your website, they check out some of your stuff, and they get really interested in them. What would you recommend as like a nice starter setup for someone that wants to get into kettlebell training?
Well, basically, I would suggest that for men, they probably would want to have maybe a 12 kilo and a 16 kilo to start with. So it'd be like a 25 pound and a 35 pound. For women, probably an 8 kilo. To start with, if they're a little bit smaller or not so experienced with strength training, you can start with maybe a 4 kilo. So maybe like a 8 pound, 9 pound, up to maybe a 20 pound for women in that range. One or two kettlebells of different weights. Start with this single kettlebell lift. So the unilateral work is going to be really good to help develop some symmetry between the right and left parts of the body. And as far as instruction and material, I would say that the book DVD combo is probably the most value, the most value for your dollar, as well as the easiest format to follow. That's called the Complete Guide to Kettlebell Lifting. That goes into over 100 different lifts, mostly around the basic techniques. It has a DVD companion to the book, so it's very clear tutorial, very easy to learn the basic exercises there. And then combine that with just some motivation and some consistency, and there's really no reason why someone can't just make really good progress training at home, training on their own, training in the office. So that's the thing about kettlebells, is it's very user-friendly, very convenient, and it's really easy to get into. So I would just encourage people to, you know, pick up a couple kettlebells, maybe just one kettlebell, pick up a good reference point, and just follow the basic exercises, and then build the volume. You don't really need a specific program to start. You just need to get moving. Stick with basic lifts like the swing. They can get all this information on my website if they go to www.ikff.com. We have plenty of information there, and they can always email us questions from that link as well.
Awesome. And one last thing that kind of popped in my head is, what are your feelings on using asymmetrical loads with the kettlebells?
I'm not opposed to it, but I think it has to be strategically placed. I don't recommend that just as something to do. In an actual program, it would be something that would be more used with a more experienced athlete. That was sometimes it would be used to strengthen if there's asymmetries. Maybe use a slightly heavier load in your non-dominant hand, for example. The other thing is just for some type of challenge, some type of neuromuscular challenge to fatigue the body in a different way. But that would more be for more advanced athletes. I mean, for general fitness, you're going to get plenty of stimulus just from doing, you know, basic single and double kettlebell lifts. When you're doing asymmetrical load, it should be a small disparity. I don't think it's a good idea to, you know, someone would use a 35 pound in one hand and a 70 pound in the other hand. Maybe a difference of, you know, 4 to 8 pounds would be good. So just a small difference. But you know, it's a training technique, just like anything else. It has some benefits, but I personally wouldn't suggest it's something to build a training program around. I think a training program should be built around the basics, the traditional single and double kettlebell lifts with symmetrical loading, and then on occasion, if you want to throw a little asymmetry in there, then that's fine. But you know, not maybe once a month or something like that. Not every time. So that's my opinion on asymmetrical loading.
Awesome. Well, Steve, thank you so much for coming on. I'm guessing the best place for people to check out some more of your stuff, and if they want to check out these DVDs, would be ikff.com.
Yes, absolutely, and I have a ton of free clips all over the internet. If you go to YouTube, go to IKFF channel on YouTube. I can put my name into YouTube. There's tons of clips there. There's a bunch of clips on my website, IKFF.com, as well as fullcontact.com. So there's plenty of just free information. People that want to get more in depth, we definitely have videos and books for purchase as well. So plenty of information, and definitely they can go to the website to find any of that.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on the show. It's been a huge pleasure, and we hope to have you again on sometime in the future.
Great. I would look forward to that, and thanks so much, Kevin, and thanks to everyone that was listening. I really appreciate that.
All right, we're in the off topic. What's up, Lee?
I'm so sick. and tired. Okay, so should we tell them why we had to delay the recording?
Yeah, let's get an update.
Yeah, so we had to delay recording because, okay, here's the thing. I'm not one of those people who, when you say to me, oh, eat this, like, it tastes funny, or smell this, it tastes bad, like, I don't do it. You know, I look at you and it's like the just sheer look on my face is like little mini ninjas coming out and attacking your head. Like, I'm like, don't, what are you, you're asking me to do that? Like, I'm not going to eat, you know? And it's probably because my grandfather, he used to eat green meat. I mean, seriously, like absolutely just, he would eat green.
Like the raw people, like the people that eat, like I saw that on Wife Swap once.
Okay. No. Like it was country ham that was like 4 years old, kind of green meat. You know, like green eggs and ham. No, it was the green ham and the yellow eggs. Like that was my grandfather, and I got sick a lot as a kid. Like I've had food poisoning an insane amount of times for a person. A person shouldn't have had food poisoning as many times as I've had food poisoning. So I know what it feels like. But I won't talk about where I was at because it was kind of depressing. But I was trying to be nice. I was trying to be nice where I was at, and they gave me shrimp, and I was like, okay, I don't even like shrimp in the first place because like something about it just really grosses me out. I think it's because like the little legs are like hanging off the thing, and it's like I don't know, like it kind of just
Beetlejuice thing.
Maybe, you know, or maybe it's just guilt. I don't know, because it's like when I see the legs of the animal, I can't have a hard time eating it after that. But anyway, you know, I eat the shrimp, and I eat some other stuff that's obviously been sitting out and warm far too long. And so, you know, the night before last, I was sitting up, and it was like 12 in the morning, and I was writing up a program, and all of a sudden I look over like to the left of me, and my stomach is literally sitting next to me saying, "You're screwed." And so there it was, and the night ensued, and I didn't go to bed until 12:30 the next morning, and now I've been up since then, since I woke up after that at like 11 o'clock last night, and somewhere around there I woke up, and I haven't been asleep since, because if I go to sleep now, then my schedule's gonna be all funky, because I'm not one of those people that can just sleep whenever they want to sleep. Like I need like basically a whole set of things in the right condition to be able to sleep anyway. So I'm going to be staying up all day, and I'm going to be fun after like 3 o'clock. It's just going to get worse and worse, but that's where, so sorry. That's why I know Fitcast on time. And that's why I know Ask Lee. And cause I was going to do the whole, like, Ask Lee podcast, and I was going to do my topic podcast and all that. And that's why none of that happened. So I don't know. That's where I'm at, Kevin. Where it is.
Can we gotta let's brighten it up a little bit. We're gonna talk a little movie stuff.
Nick and Nora.
Well, this is a deal. It's because I've seen this movie like on demand on every premium channel that I've had for probably since before Christmas, for like 6 months. And you know, I think Michael Cera is a pretty funny dude. And I saw the preview for it like a year ago. And like, man, that probably looked like a movie that I would like. But, you know, I was never in the mood to watch it then. I was searching through on demand, and I'm like, man, there it is. I haven't watched it yet. And this is kind of like a sign that maybe I should watch it. I knew what I was getting into. I really did. And I knew that it's weird when you know you're going to watch a movie that will probably make you happy. and then you watch it and like, yep, that made me happy. Why didn't I do that earlier? But the awesome movie, you know, you have it's a very cute movie. Like you have, like there's awesome sexual tension between these two people throughout the whole movie, which is like, it's like, man, you know, I've been there before. Like I remember that. Like, and you kind of wish you could have lived that night with those two people to kind of experience it with them. And like, man, you know, why don't I go out till 5 in the morning in the middle of the city and do stuff like that? But I mean, I'm not going to ruin it for anyone that's seen it, but it's, the music in it is fantastic. Like the music, it's right down my alley. Like that's like the music that I listen to. And you know, I saw like the opening credits, I see like Vampire Weekend show. I'm like, done deal. And the whole thing had a smile on my face the whole time. Awesome writing, you know, great. You it's kind of predictable. You kind of know where it's going to be going. It's broken up into a couple parts, and you kind of know, like, oh, they're going to be together, then they're going to be ripped apart, then they're going to find their way back together, and you know, it's kind of standard, but it doesn't make it any less awesome. And then I think I finished the movie at 10 p.m. last night. Then I bought the soundtrack on iTunes, and I then stayed up till about 1 in the morning listening to the soundtrack. I couldn't go to bed because I was so, like, I was just in such, like, a good mood from watching that movie, and it breathes life into you. Like, it gives you energy, and the soundtrack is top-notch. Like, every song on it is fantastic, and I really think that if people have, if you're kind of a fan of not necessarily that indie, but that, like, alternative music, that, you know, I've kind of mentioned, and Lee's kind of mentioned on the show a lot, like, if you're into, like the Phoenix, kind of like the electric music that's not necessarily emo, but it kind of is, like Vampire Weekend and all those different bands that just, like, it's like, man, that sounds like nothing else I've heard before, and it even made me continue to buy two more CDs from, you know, it stinks because I had that damn iPad on my lap, and that's why I was like, while halfway through the movie, I buy the thing on my iPad. Then, while, you know, it was one of the slower parts of the movie, I go to see the artists and see what other CDs that they have and listen to a couple of tracks. And if I find three good songs on a CD, I'll usually buy the whole thing, just because I'm a completionist. But yeah, really recommend you check it out. Check out the soundtrack as well. And this is another random one, and I don't know if people have heard this this band, but it's called Stars.
Oh yeah, Canada baby.
Yeah, and their CD Heart, which I first got.
Very excellent. Oh, very excellent.
And it's so weird. It's just like one of those things that you kind of have to be in the right mood to listen to. But I started like listening to it, and I was like plowing through. I was just like plowing through emails. Like early in the day, I was like, man, this is Sunday. It's my day off. I'm not gonna do anything. I just want to chill out and not stress out about stuff. And I ended up just staying up till the 1 in the morning working. I'm trying to finish up that interview I'm doing for Virgin, trying to get that thing sent back to them. And I'm like, man, I'm just, why am I writing like 3-paragraph answers? I gotta cut this stuff out. I gotta shut the hell up. But that's just how I am. I ramble. And,
That's awesome. I love Stars. The last album they released was, In Your Bedroom After the War, but, yeah. Heart is a great album, and it's still my favorite of theirs. But Romantic Comedy is like just absolutely one of my favorite songs of all time. I love Elevator Love Letter and Look Up Shang too, and it's great, you know.
Maybe I'll open the podcast with that song.
You should.
15 seconds, so I don't get sued, and I'm going to make sure that song is from Heart, and you can check them out on iTunes, and you should.
In general, I have a very big love relationship with most Canadian artists in the indie.
Paramore's Canadian too, right?
I have no idea if they are Canadian.
Well, you should love Paramore, and if you don't, it's a sad, sad state of affairs.
Emily Haynes, Metric.
Yes.
Canadian.
Yes.
Canadian. So yeah, there's a lot of good Canada.
Great alternative, like electric music coming from up there. Like it's, I don't know why, but maybe it's because I like video games, but the beeps and the bloops and the squeeps and the squops really get to me. And I was trying to make a Spaceballs reference. The bleeps, the creeps.
I think Nick and Nora is cute. It's kind of like a younger High Fidelity. I mean, I love any movie that's based upon like a principle of mixtapes or mixes in general. And I mean, God, when I was like 19, I was a member of the Art of the Mix website. I'm not even kidding. Like when I was, and basically the whole point of the website is to make mixes and mix CDs and post them up and get commented on what your mixes are. I mean, I don't know many people that are obsessed with mix CDs or mixtapes or anything like that as I am. It was how I got into many relationships and complications as a young one, and probably in truth still as an adult, and it would lead there as well. But still, like, I love that kind of stuff. So it couldn't be happier, that kind of thing. So yay! I'm glad you liked it, Kevin. And I'm glad you found Stars, because I love Stars.
Oh, ever since I was a senior in college, I think, believe it or not, I think I found them through Pandora.
Oh, okay.
And I was listening to... Oh, man, I don't use Pandora as much as I should, because I tend to, and this is a really bad habit, but like, I just got that CD last night. I've been playing the crap out of it. Just, I listened to it over and over, and I did it with the new Vampire Weekend CD, Contra. Also, you know, first off, awesome video game, but Contra, where, you know, there's three or four songs that I just listen to over and over and again, and even just going to work, like, you know, you go to work and you just want to, like, make sure you're in that, like, awesome mood. You want to inject some energy, like listening to Giving Up the Gun, awesome, awesome song by Vampire Weekend. It will just get you, you know, ready. It'll get you ready to go. Also, Get Phoenix. Great CD.
Yeah, good CD. Good CD. I fell in love with them when I saw Shallow Hal for the first time. And I was like, what is that song?
They had a song in Shallow Hal?
It was when he goes to the club and they're dancing, and it's the song Too Young. And it's the album was okay. I didn't expect Phoenix to blow up and change the way that they did. And the album was okay, that it came out of United. Phoenix United was the album that it was on, and the song is called Too Young. But they're just dancing in the club, and there was something about the song that just gave me the happiest little feeling on the face of the earth. So I loved Phoenix kind of ever since then.
But, oh shit! I'm gonna blow your mind, Lee.
What?
You know, they have a whole CD of remixes from Wolfgang Amadeus?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I didn't know this. Hold on, I'm purchasing this right now. If we start getting, like, the internet starts dying, it's not my fault. Holy crap, I never knew about this. Yeah, it's weird. Like, I will, lately I've been... I have this alarm thing on my computer because my computer's a little bit, a couple of feet from my bed, so it forced me to get out of bed. But there's this alarm application, and it allows you to obviously wake up to music. And like waking up to like Listomania, or like waking up to, you know, I've been like Paramore songs, like, and Angel, it's, I know it's super, like, super lame, but Angels and Airwaves, like, that stuff's good.
I used to wake up to Frou-Frou. Like, I woke up, yes, to like the whole Frou-Frou. I woke up to like the whole Frou-Frou album for like, I think, 2 months straight back in, like, I don't know.
Oh, four probably. Was it during like when, yeah, Garden State came out? Like, yeah.
I think sometimes during that period of time, I think I woke up to that whole Frou-Frou Details album. Like, every day.
Oh, waking up to Let Go just sounds like,
yes, no, really, no, I'm like right there with you. I loved waking up to Let Go. I mean, you know, and it's
or Breathe In also. If you don't, also Frou-Frou, check them out. It's just, you know, it's this woman, and the song's called Details, or the CD, awesome.
Yeah.
Oh man, let's just do a, screw the Fic House. Let's just talk about music.
Yeah, let's do that.
No.
Take me home. I love that song. I haven't listened to Elevator Love Later in a while. That's a good song.
You should do it.
I'm listening to it right now. It's good stuff.
Have you, you know, we'll spend one more minute on this, but just some other stuff out there. Like, if you have same musical taste, I really recommend that you check out, I mean, how could you have not already, but Silver Sun Pickups have a relatively new CD out, and
good stuff.
Yeah, I think that's, and also, you don't forget Tears for Fears.
Oh, never. Yeah,
Head
never.
Over Heels, download classic. It now.
Classic.
And classic. Yeah, man, I just like, movies need to have soundtracks. like that. Like I think it's unless it's produced by Zach Braff or you know I or like it's this movie. I feel like I
wow.
Yeah, I have a dog.
Oh, that little
I'm the only one home right now, so he is trying to protect the house.
Yeah, good boy.
Could be a UPS delivery man.
My dog attacks the FedEx and UPS man. He's so cliche.
Well, that's the thing. Like he'll like once the door opens, like if someone comes into the house, he'll like start like being the best dog ever. Or start like jumping up on the person and like being like, "Oh, yo, I want to meet you. I want to meet you." And I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah, let's record the podcast.
Okay, fine, whatever.